The title of this presentation is The Platte of Zion, A Comparison of American Ideal Cities. This is probably a subject, as I got into it, I was starting to wonder, maybe if I'd bitten off a little bit more than I could chew. I've kept working at it and got something I think is presentable and coherent, but the subject matter turns out, as I got into it, is quite extensive as I was doing some of the reading and research. My abstract just talks about, again, ideal cities, so you kind of have an idea of what this is about, having their origin in certain Renaissance ideas, which actually in turn drew upon even more ancient ideas. The Mormon city of Zion was actually, in many ways, falls into this conception of an ideal city that we're going to kind of define and discuss here. And so what I'm going to do is look at it in that context, compare it with some other ideal cities, like Philadelphia, which actually started off under something called the Holy Experiment, and then Savannah, Georgia, believe it or not, was another ideal city that in its original conception had to do with certain utopian and egalitarian concepts that were prevalent at the time. So I guess the thing to do is just kind of starting in with the introduction here. And I found this quote in a position paper talking about how the ideal city has always been a kind of quest equivalent to the search for the precious object or knowledge of sacred and mythic narrative, kind of a grail quest. Because it's one of the things we're going to see in all these ideal cities, they're not always realized, and the few that do see some realization, it's usually kind of short-lived. So what is an ideal city? So based on the literature that I've been going over, it's basically a city whose layout, talking about the way the city's laid out, and its planning basically revolves around certain ethical, philosophical, or religious principles. And we're going to see that in the case of a lot of these cities here. My thing over there, okay. And is considered to be something of a model living situation, the ideal place for the expression of these particular values and ideas. Okay. And always central to the idea of any ideal city was some sort of precise, well thought out, well proportioned geometrical pattern. Now that pattern varied in terms of which, you know, what the principles were and what city we're dealing with. Okay, I thought that was an interesting quote here. Cities have always been deeply symbolic. The designs of streets and squares, temples, palaces have all been used at one time or another to project ideas about man's place in the universe. Okay, now let's start looking at some actual ideal cities. Now these are more Renaissance ideal cities. Tessa Morrison wrote a paper discussing Christianopolis and the City of the Sun, which are two Renaissance cities, and goes into considerable detail in that paper. There's the reference if anyone's interested. As far as how the geometric patterns of these cities were intended to highlight the structure and order of their societies, and how it was to express the basic philosophy of the individuals that came up with these ideal cities. So the first one, the City of the Sun, was proposed by Tommaso Campanella, who was a Dominican friar and philosopher. He was a rather interesting individual, frequently getting in trouble with the authorities in his days for many of his political activities, philosophical and theological viewpoints. At one time, he was an astrological advisor to the Pope, which probably back in the day wasn't that unusual a thing. Astrology was taken a little more seriously than it is today. But in 1602, he basically comes up with this idea about the City of the Sun. Okay, so his basic influences were Thomas More's Utopia, the great work in English that discusses this model idealized society. The City of the Sun, as Campanella envisioned it, was basically a Christian utopian society. It had a strong emphasis on moral theology. There was a stressed common ownership of property. And what one author discussing this whole idea of millenarianism and millennialism, catalytic millennialism. Okay, and we'll see that another example, actually two more examples of catalytic millennialism. One that's probably a little more familiar with people here, or at least it's the subject of this talk. Okay, catalytic millennialism is the idea that you create this idealized society. Once this idealized society is in place, it leads to the creation or of basically virtuous people. Okay? And once that gets into play, it will have some effect in bringing about the reign of Christ. Okay? That might sound a little familiar. Emphasis, there was a strong emphasis in the city of Sun on education, technology, and science in society. And Campanella was very much into the Greek philosophers. He didn't base this on, you know, his emphasis wasn't on the writings and the teachings of Catholic saints as much as it was some of the Plato and Aristotle, and the emphasis on that. Well, not so much Aristotle, but some of the other Greek philosophers. Layout and organization of the city follows a distinct geometric pattern. His city was circular. And I found this very interesting. At the very center of it, he had a temple where basically all the roads, it was like the temple was the hub of this wheel, a circular wheel, and the roads were kind of leading to it. It almost looks like a wheel. Okay, he allowed for distinct areas for communal kitchens, barns, and stores of tools and utensils. And the main roads, of course, oriented to the four cardinal directions. Okay, and that's the only picture I could find of any resolution. So you kind of see in here, this is that temple area here. And then, kind of like almost like a wagon wheel, these are like the spokes going to the hub there. I was also kind of interesting that a Catholic theologian was interested in creating a society with the temple at the center of it. That was kind of interesting.
Lots of traffic jam.
Yeah. Christianopolis by the Lutheran scholar John Valentinus Andrei. A well-known theologian and author in his day, mostly, if you people remember him today, though, it's because of some writings, I don't know if you remember the whole Dan Brown and all that stuff, and the Holy Grail, Holy Blood, Holy Grail thing, kind of thing, and the Rosicrucians. He is the author of one of the more important Rosicrucian documents, The Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkrantz, which he later in life said he wrote as a joke, and just people took it too seriously. So he publishes his description of this Christianopolis, which he envisaged not as a single city, but eventually encompassing a whole republic, a whole nation. He was inspired by Campanella. Again, it's another Christian utopian society with a lot of the same features, strong moral theology, common ownership of property, still has that catalytic millennialism going on there. Emphasis on education and technology, all that stuff. The layout of his city was a little different. Instead of this circular city with a temple at the kind of being the hub, his pattern that he came up with was a series of concentric squares. But this Lutheran scholar, like the Catholic one, also envisaged that this ideal city will have a temple around which all this is arranged. Okay? Again, distinct areas for storehouses, living quarters, etc., oriented to the four cardinal directions. So this is a direct drawing of it here. So this is the temple area that he envisaged, and everything kind of is arranged around that. So, some interesting differences and parallels that we see going on here. Now, let's talk about more along the actual subject that we're hitting on here, the city of Zion. So, a little bit of historical framework here. 1829, Joseph Smith receives a commandment to seek to bring forth and establish the cause of Zion. Now, this is prior to the establishment of the church. Okay? And then 1831, there's several things I've got listed here. So the law of consecration is given. He receives a revelation that the city of Zion is to be built, that they're to try to build this, intend to build this in the land of Missouri. And then the Temple Lot site consecrated also in that same year. The United Firm is organized in 1832, which was, you probably know, was kind of a, how you want to say it, kind of a precursor to the United Order or an earlier version of it. So it's kind of organized in 1832. The Plat of Zion, that urban layout that he comes up with, and actually went through a couple of early forms, comes out in 1833. United Firm dissolved the following year, is later going to be reorganized as the United Order. Okay? And then, put 1838, after several years of persecution, the Mormons are forcibly expulsed from Missouri. Okay? And I've got some scriptures here. So the Mormon city of Zion, this is the earlier revelation that I received. Now as you have been asked, behold, I say unto you, keep my commandments and seek to bring forth and establish the cause of Zion. Okay, so there's this active, plan, or it becomes an active plan at one time to establish the city of Zion. Now behold, I say unto you, this is not the same one I had before, but now I say unto you that it is not revealed, and no man knoweth where the city Zion shall be built, but it shall be given hereafter, which it was. Behold, I say unto you that it shall be on the borders by the Lamanites. And then this further additional revelation that Zion cannot be built up unless it is by the principles of the law of the celestial kingdom. Otherwise, I cannot receive her unto myself. So there was this expectation of creating an idealized society, establishing first this ideal city of Zion. Now let's continue on. Okay, so there's just and probably most of you know this, but some principles of the law of consecration. Support the poor. Okay? So there weren't to be any poor in Zion. The poor were to be provided for. Every man equal according to his family, according to his circumstances and his wants and needs. Property beyond that which was needed was consecrated for use and distribution by the bishop. So as people needed items, the bishop, you all know this, would say, okay, well, this person over here needs a little this over here, they need a little bit of that. It also allows for the purchase of lands for the building up of the New Jerusalem. Okay, so one of the things they were actively engaged in is acquiring not only the immediate area that was to be the land of Zion, but for the purchase of additional lands to build it up, to make it larger. Pride and idleness to be avoided. This was to be a society where people worked and did as much as they could. And of course, the obvious ones, church to follow revelation, proclaim the gospel to the world. Zion was not envisaged to fill the earth. To fill the earth. It wasn't envisaged to be a single, one place only city. And that to a lesser extent, that was true for the City of the Sun and Christianopolis. Where Zion is different is they were more or less envisaged to be large-scale areas, at least initially. And then, this Zion is intended to eventually fill up the entire world. Okay, it's not a single city. It's, as a biologist, I think of a, you start off with, you know, an organism starts off as a single cell, like we all did, as we keep adding cells and getting larger and larger and larger till we eventually attain the full-fledged organismal stature. And that's kind of how I understand this. So every time they would get an area filled up, they would lay out a new area and fill it up, and it would just keep growing in that manner. Okay. One of the, I guess you'd call models in many ways, or certainly was there in their ideas of what this city of Zion was, Enoch's city. Quotation here, scriptural quotation, and the Lord called his people Zion because they are of one heart, one mind, and dwelt in righteousness. There was no poor. So that kind of suggests this communally oriented society, much like the city of Zion that the Mormons were originally intending to build up. So kind of a give you a quick rundown of some of the ideas that I got out of all that so far, were that in 19th century Mormonism, the saints were to build up the city of Zion and keep expanding it. Ultimately, its goal is to fill the entire earth, okay, is include all peoples, okay. The city of Enoch City appears to have been a model for this, there seems to be, according to some scholars, and I cite one here, the idea is this is not something that's going to be accomplished in the millennium, but this is like Campanella's and Andrei's societies. It's to initiate, in some sense, the millennium. The saints are to build up the city of Zion, you know, start leading the virtuous lives, fulfill those requirements. And this would catalyze the initiation of the kingdom of God, of Christ's reign on earth. It was an early viewpoint. That's kind of been modified since then. But let's look at the actual plat itself. I'm assuming some people have seen it. So it's actually the actual physical layout of the city itself. Okay. The original plan and idea was based around a more of an agricultural, agrarian type of community where people would grow the food, and there were actually provisions made for, you know, land to grow crops on. Also has plans for schools, meeting houses, storehouses, and residences as part of this communal experiment. Probably no big surprise. Organized around a central temple complex. And the original document actually specified for 12 temples. Again, everything is oriented along the four cardinal directions. Okay, so there's a picture of it. Actually, this is a little plate on it. So it's been a little colorized, this version, but to actually see it, how it's actually oriented north and south, you kind of have to rotate it that way. So here's the central temple complex, everything kind of organized in a grid-like fashion around that.
Are you saying north is at that top?
Yeah, right?
North is on that side.
Yeah. The papers.
Oh, I see.
Like that.
And those three temple blocks are the temple?
Well, there's temple and other church buildings, meeting houses that go in that area. Mm-hmm. But the 12, I think, and there's some other buildings as well along that line. And some things, there were some allusions to 12 temples, or I'm sorry, 24 temples as well. So I don't know if they were to expand off into that later on. I was a little uncertain reading this. A picture similar to this, it's not colorized, is actually, I don't know if anyone knows the Joseph Smith Papers website, which has a number of scans of early Mormon documents. And this is not this colorized version, but there is a version of this. It actually shows an earlier version as well. That's kind of a cool thing, but you can actually go and, you know, look at the documents and zoom in on them, and then they've got a little, along the side, a little translation of what they're actually saying, because some of this handwriting is, gets a little hard to read at times.
Of course, there's that little brass plaque in the thing over in the partly in the pedestrian walk over Main Street at City Creek Mall that has it.
If you're talking about what I think you are, we'll see that. Okay. So what about the American grid system? Now, organized, this was organized out in a grid-like manner, and that, so that was actually one of the things that actually initiated my interest in this whole subject. Even though I'm a biologist, I had taken some kind of fun. I work at Salt Lake Community College, some surveying courses just for kind of fun, and they would start talking about grid systems in the United States and other places. So that's kind of what provoked my interest in all this initially. Grid system. Actually, grid systems have been in use since ancient times. A lot of really ancient cities in the Indus Valley civilization, certain places in Egypt, some Greek and Roman cities were actually laid out in a grid-like manner. And it kind of makes sense that you would see that from time to time, because, you know, it's kind of a natural thing. You orient it, you got north, south, east, and west, just lay things out accordingly. Even though that's so, many cities, including some early American cities, were not using a grid plan, though there were a few that did. Now, some that actually did use a grid plan were the New Haven colony, and something we'll be talking about in just a few minutes, Philadelphia. Okay, the New Haven colony actually was a separate English colony in what is now modern Connecticut, and it later joins with the Connecticut colony and New Haven, Connecticut. This is the basis for the city of New Haven, Connecticut. So you kind of see, again, something of a grid-like pattern. Now, what we're going to see is, just because you've seen one grid, you haven't seen them all. There's a lot of variation on these themes as to how these grids are laid out. Okay, but nevertheless, we kind of have this organization here around a kind of a central square area. Okay, other examples, parts of the early layout of Washington, D.C. by L'Enfant was Washington, D.C., but it kind of had one of these variations where you had the grid, and then you had certain streets kind of going at diagonal to the grid running along that. It's kind of a weird-looking thing. I don't know if you've ever gone on Google Earth and kind of looked at the layout of Washington, D.C., but you see grid-like areas, and then you see these diagonal roadways going through it. Manhattan. Part of Manhattan was actually developed in a grid-like manner, according to the commissioner's plan of 1811. Out west here, west of the Mississippi, I'm not a Westerner, but I grew up in Indiana, but a lot of Western cities, this is a fairly common feature. Salt Lake City, I guess everybody knows that. Oklahoma City, Austin, and somewhere in all my readings, I come across that Dodge City was actually laid out according to a grid-like pattern.
As was Tulsa.
Well, Tulsa, yeah, there's probably a number of them, yeah. So you think of, usually you think of Dodge City for other reasons, but all these Westerns that you see in the movies and stuff. So some examples of other American ideal cities, and these are by definitions that I've given before, ideal cities, and they're laid out according to grids, a grid-type system, though this one is a very unique one. Savannah, Georgia turns out to be very unique in how they carried out their grid. So Philadelphia is part of that holy experiment, and then Savannah, Georgia laid out as kind of the core city for something called the Oglethorpe Plan. So there's Philadelphia. The idea for Philadelphia, what does it mean? City of brotherly love. Okay, well, why it wasn't something that they thought was really cool to say. It kind of was intended to encapsulate certain Quaker ideas about equality and how a proper society should be run. Okay. Penn, of course, as you know, was a Quaker, a philosopher, and a social reformer, and he is the founder of what was referred to as the province of Pennsylvania. Nowadays, we just say the Pennsylvania colony, or the colony of Pennsylvania. He was somewhat of a prolific writer on, wrote a number of books on Quakerism, and his interest was to get back somehow or another to primitive, the principles of primitive Christianity. He was also well known in his day for being one of the, for really being strong in maintaining good relationships with the Native Americans, the Lenape people, or sometimes they're referred to as the Delaware Indian people. He wouldn't allow, it probably happened without his knowledge, but wouldn't allow people to go out into their territories carrying guns. And he didn't. And when he traveled out there, he went unarmed. And the Native peoples respected him for that. He was on very good relationships with them. Unfortunately, after his death, his sons kind of ruined that in a little scheme. They come up to bilk the Native Americans out of some of their land, the so-called Walking Purchase Treaty. So they were didn't live up to their father's ideals. Philadelphia, inspired by Quaker utopian principles, that's the whole idea of the holy experiment. Again, it was intended to be, again, a kind of a Christian-based society. One book said it was probably less utopian and more along the line of egalitarian individualism. And they said that had to do with this concept of the inner light that is a central idea in much of Quaker theology. George Fox, the founder of the Quaker denomination, had this principle that of God in every man, in every person. There could be some aspect of God found in everyone. Okay, and they focused on this concept of the inner light, that there was this inner light that everyone had in them, and through study of the scriptures and living a virtuous life, that inner light would get larger and they could have a more direct experience of God. So, in contrast to these others that were more catalytic millennialism, the Quakers, on the basis of this inner light, were more of a spiritual millennialism. They didn't emphasize so much the literal coming of Christ to reign on the earth. They said, as people live virtuous lives and try to live as God intends them for, they will have this, how you want to say, Christ experience or godly experience in themselves, and more people do that, that would be a much more, in their viewpoint, practical type of millennialism that could be established at this moment. So they had more of an emphasis on that type of millennialism. Still an emphasis on education for all children, and they were known for educating not only male children, but female children as well. There was still and you have to remember the time they were living in, kind of a societal division between the duties and responsibilities of males and females, true, but they did make sure that all were properly educated. Layout and organization of the city followed, again, a distinctive geometric pattern. Again, a well-defined grid, as you saw. Okay. Organized around a large town square center, okay? And then he was big in what he, Penn was, in what he called green country towns. He believed these cities to be healthy, more beneficial to the people. They should have lots of trees. Like, we shouldn't be cutting down trees, but have lots of areas, city parks and squares, where trees were in somewhat abundance. So there's kind of the picture there. That Thomas Holmes, who was the actual surveyor who laid out So here's the city's square around, which is kind of laid around. Here are these areas where they're making provisions, particularly you can see the trees there, where they're making provisions for the trees in their green country town. The word, the phrase holy experiment actually comes from a comments that he made in a letter to a friend. I left the friend's name off. His friend's name was James Harrison. But he was writing to some of his ideas and goals and what he hoped to accomplish. And for my country, I aid the Lord in obtaining it, and more was I drawn inward to look to him and to owe it to his hand and power than to any other way. I have so obtained it and desire to keep it, that I may not be unworthy of his love, but do that which may answer his kind providence, serve his truth and people, that an example may be set up to the nations, that there may be room there, though not here, for such an holy experiment. So it was his attempt to put into some practical application the principles of Quakerism. Now, for something a little bit different, in a number of different ways. Savannah, Georgia, the idea comes from James Oglethorpe, who was, he has a number of hats that he wore. He was a social reformer and philanthropist. He was the founder of what was the province of Georgia, which is originally a small piece of the province of Carolina. Carolina at the time included not only North and South Carolina, Tennessee, parts of Alabama, Georgia, and a little thin slice of what is northern Florida. He was a military man, was a British general. He was a Freemason and actually organized the first, it's the oldest, continually operating Masonic lodge in America. Okay? So, and that might be a little interesting idea to bring out a little later on about that relationship. It was inspired by a previous utopian model called the Grand Model. That's not a typo, having the two L's there. For the province of Carolina, was a utopian idea. And this is, we're talking about what Carolina was as defined then. It was a vast tract of land. Was more of an Anglican utopia. Oglethorpe, even though he was a professing Anglican and Christian, it's on record that he criticized certain ideas because he felt they went against the gospel of Christ. Savannah, Georgia, unlike some of the other ideal cities that we've talked about, was not organized along religious or Christian principles per se. He wasn't against it, but that's not how it was organized. Rather, he was into the ideas of the Enlightenment. He had a strong humanist viewpoint. And as one of the authors points out, there are clearly Freemasonic concepts that show up in his ideas and organization of Savannah, Georgia. A number of historians, as I said, have commented on the fact that while he wasn't against organized religion per se, and was actually a professing Anglican, he made no provision for that specifically in his conception of Savannah, Georgia. Rather, he seemed to have, and this is perhaps with the principles of the Enlightenment and humanism, seemed to be more into the ideas of what is called the political virtue of Republican Rome and not the religious virtue of the ancient Hebrews. That's kind of an interesting thing. English model in terms of how the day-to-day business affairs were to be carried out, divided between commercial and agrarian interests. And again, we have what is a very unique compared to anything else that we've seen up to this time, grid-like pattern. He comes up with what he calls wards. Okay, his wards were four tithing blocks. These were residential blocks. I'll show you what this means. So there would be areas where you had residential tithing means, residential plots, and then they'd be around these trust or civil plots that would be could be used for the community. So there's, let me just kind of show. So
this would be a ward here, okay? So there would be, I should say this would be the ward. So here's one tithing block. So there's 10 lots there. Here's another one. And then here would be the trust or civil lots.
Like town squares?
He must have, yeah. Because so that's how they would be used.
The common areas.
Yeah, well, these would be for common areas. There are also provisions, if necessary, for the building of certain civil buildings for the civil administration. Training of militia. Also, they could be used in case of war as areas of refuge. So he kind of had a lot of things going on there.
Is that how it's actually developed?
The original historical Savannah
looks like that?
Well, not all of it, but it's just the historical part of what the old town Savannah, yeah. Still retains somewhat of that, okay? Again, he was intending for this to spread out through at least Georgia, maybe other areas. That was a little short-lived. There's only one other town in Georgia that follows that plan. I forget its name right now. But so what we see in a lot of these cities, the if they do get started, do get realized in any sense, they tend to be very short-lived.
Yeah, because they're depending upon people's giving up their freedom to the group,
right?
To group management, and that, you know, it's going to be hard to manage.
So anyway, so it's a comparison. So the city of Zion and other ideal cities sought to create societies built on ethical principles that would benefit the lives of their citizens, although philosophical and or theological principles between these obviously varied. In the cases examined here, these, unlike some of these utopian societies, we usually think of utopian societies, you know, like the Amana Society, New Harmony, things like that. Another one that's kind of more late 19th century, early 20th century, the Coruscant Unity in Florida, which were kind of isolated, intended for just a small number or a small group of people. These guys instead all envisaged extensively large areas that could get larger and benefit a very significant population. Okay, the city of Zion, like the Renaissance examples, but not like the American ideal examples that I use, tended to exhibit some version of what would, we could be referred to as a catalytic millennialism. And then, of course, the layouts of these cities always followed well-defined geometric patterns. And the plan of Zion and the American example, some version of the grid plan, okay? And there's somebody mentioned that. Is that what you were talking about? In 2015, an award was presented in recognition of the Plat of Zion influencing the layout of Salt Lake City. Is that,
actually,
something
new? There is a map of the layout of Salt Lake City with the wards indicated and so on in bronze.
Oh.
Right in
oh.
The set in the floor.
And that's where again?
In the pedestrian overpass over Main Street.
I've never seen that. Because I mentioned I'm not a native of Utah, so I'm still learning things as I go by here.
It actually shows how the layout was implemented.
Cool, that's neat. So anyway, was there anything else? Zion, at least in this verse of the scripture, and that's what I'm going to close with, is the pure in heart, defined as the pure in heart. And I think that's the real significance of all this in terms of the Mormon concept of Zion, the Plat of Zion, this attempt to obtain a people pure in heart before the Lord. Okay, so that's my presentation. Thank you for sticking with me here. I guess we've still got a few minutes, even though we got started late here with the technical difficulties. I don't know if anybody, hopefully I can answer your questions. That's all.
Yeah, so where do you think Joseph Smith got the inspiration to come up with this plan for the city of Zion? Because I think it's more extensive.
Oh yeah.
When you look at the patterns that you've shown, I think it was.
I think that is a combination of seeing some of these other cities, because he would have known about some of these cities back east, And then, of course, having revelation would have further enhanced and developed that. The thing I think of is an Old Testament reference where Moses is having a difficulty handling the affairs of the people. He asks his father-in-law, Jethro, what he should do, and then he tells him to appoint these things, you know, so many people to help him and everything. And then later on, that seems to be not the basis, but because he starts doing that, that allows for the creation of the 70 to get filled with the Holy Spirit and act in a more direct manner, to act like a little, what we call it, mini Moseses. So that's kind of my idea. You start working on one thing, you start thinking of this idea, and that allows for the development of new ideas to come along.